The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly, and I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, proof that you don't need a written constitution to have a constitutional crisis. How did a footballer caught playing away end up causing a blazing row between Parliament and the judiciary? Also this week, Barack Obama jets in on Air Force One to sprinkle a bit of stardust over Westminster.
Our relationship is special because of the values and beliefs that have united our people through the ages.
But what of his own hopes for re-election next year? And why is he looking in such command when closer to home, the right is inflicting rout after rout, as we saw in Spain only this week? Joining me in the studio, we have three top Guardian commentators, Polly Toynbee, Martin Kettle and Anne Perkins. Welcome to you all. Well, the moment of the parliamentary week came early on in the guise of John Hemming, a backbench Lib Dem MP who probably wouldn't normally expect to steal the limelight.
With about 75,000 people having named Ryan Giggs on Twitter, it's obviously impracticable to imprison them all. And with reports that Giles Corran also faces imprisonment...
Order! Let me just say to the honourable gentleman, I know that he's already done it, but occasions such as this... Order! ...are occasions for raising the issues of principle involved, not seeking to flout for whatever purpose. If the Honourable Order, the Honourable General wants to finish his question in an orderly way, he can do so. Mr John Hemming.
Now, you might be completely indifferent to the sex lives of footballers, but in naming the Manchester United player, John Hemming was acting in blatant defiance of a court order. He was relying on the concept of parliamentary privilege, but it set off an almighty row. The Guardian's top lawyer, Jill Phillips, is here to give us chapter and verse.
First of all, there's a sort of long-standing tradition within the House of Parliament that where an issue is waiting determination by the courts, that issue won't be discussed by the House. And that's set out in some sub judice rules of each House. And I think Erskine May, which is the sort of Bible of parliamentary rules and procedure, makes that position clear.
So that is to say that Parliament, by setting its own customs, has traditionally decided not to meddle in what's properly the business of the court.
Absolutely, you know, because both sides are sensitive to trespassing on the other's lawn. And, you know, that represents the sort of what I suppose in formal language is the proper separation of powers and respect for the rule of law that Parliament shows. So you've got that on one hand. It has its own sub judice rules, and those rules are, you know, enforced by the Speaker. The Speaker calls the shots on those. And then you've got Article 9 of the Bill of Rights, 1689, which sets out that, you know, the freedom of speech and debates or proceedings in Parliament ought not to be impeached or questioned in any court or place out of Parliament. So that provides an absolute privilege for whatever's said in Parliament, for those in Parliament. That's pretty much the way it is. You know, there's nobody, nothing that can interfere with the business of Parliament, and not just the courts, the Crown as well, because, of course, you know, the timing of the Bill of Rights follows on from the spat between Charles and Cromwell and the English Civil War. So it goes back a long way in those terms. But then what you've got when it comes to the position of the media is, to be honest, uncertainty. And whereas it is clear, because the Defamation Act makes it clear, that there is absolute privilege for the media in defamation terms for reporting things that are said in Parliament, there is no such equivalent position that covers the media when they're reporting matters said in Parliament that may amount to a breach of a court order. And, you know, on one level, it makes a nonsense to say that Parliament can say what it likes within its own walls, but then nobody can report it, because that seems to undermine the sort of fundamental process that was behind allowing Parliament to say what they wanted to.
Well, blimey, Jill, thanks for that summary of privilege down the ages. But I suppose what most people are wondering now is what happens next?
Obviously, Cameron's now set up a joint committee, hasn't he, of both houses to look at these issues generally. I mean, I'm not sure that what their mandate is, but one imagines that they're going to have to look at whether they interfere on the law of privacy, whether they try to redefine it, whether they decide to leave it to the courts, whether they alter the threshold test that's in Section 12 of the Human Rights Act as to when you can and can't get an injunction. And also, presumably, they're going to look, you know, at their own procedures and their own sub judice rules.
So, Anne Perkins, John Hemming, a self-serving MP who's contemptuous of the rule of law, or the one man with the common sense and the bravery to tell the truth that the law has become an ass?
I always hesitate to attack people who stand up and receive showers of ordure from all their peers and colleagues, because I think you need awkward people around the place. But there is actually a straightforward system for dealing with this, and I'm afraid John Hemming's got form on this, and he's caused a lot of trouble, not in a good way, to individual people by insisting on breaching court rules. And I think this was an ill-advised attempt to ride on the high horse of openness.
But Polly, it's not just MPs at the moment, is it? We had Ermine Trimmed Rebellion with Lord Stonehouse naming Fred Goodwin, didn't we?
Yes, it seems to be that the legislature is losing a sense of the red line between what they do and what judges do. We do have a law. We have, in effect, privacy law, which was passed in Parliament as part of the Human Rights Act. And there it is. If they don't like it, they can change the law. But what they can't do is second-guess the judges in carrying out what Parliament has told them to do. And it's an absolute disgrace that they have been pitting themselves against the judiciary, saying this is judge-made law and judges are overstepping the mark, and challenging particular cases and actual judgments rather than principles, which, of course, they're allowed to challenge, and they can change the law any time they want. But I think it's very important that we realise that this is quite a major assault, a sort of tin opener on the whole of the Human Rights Act, which a lot of people in Parliament, or particularly on the Tory side, want to do away with. And there are quite a lot of people, Labour, and even these days, people like Lord McNally on the Lib Dem side, also saying perhaps we should be looking again at the Human Rights Act. And if you talk to people like Liberty, they are very alarmed that the privacy law has been used in this way.
The interesting thing here, Martin, and Polly talks there about it, comes from the Human Rights Act, and that, of course, enshrined the European Convention. But when the eminent lawyers who sat down to draft that after the Second World War enshrined the right to privacy and family life, they didn't necessarily think they were protecting the right of people to go and leave their families in the lurch while they, without being gossiped about.
Well, I mean, the Convention and indeed the Human Rights Act that Polly was just talking about sets up various rights which have to be reconciled, and that and one of those is privacy, and another of them is freedom of speech. And the problem in this case is not that those things can't be balanced and reconciled, because over many decades they have been. The issue now is partly because, as Polly says, there is a controversy about the Human Rights Act, but it's also because of the spread of the internet, which both in technological terms and in, as it were, philosophical terms, is very much dedicated to the whole notion of freedom and lack of supervision and independence. And so, you know, the law still says what the law used to say, but the means by which you can flout the law are now much greater, and that's why these events have been set in train. It can only be resolved by Parliament. You know, there isn't any great constitutional uncertainty as to who makes the laws in this country. Parliament makes the laws, and the judges interpret them. But, you know, it's down to Parliament to assert itself in this way. And, you know, the politics of this is that Parliament could do that, but Parliament is also, MPs individually and parties in particular and government, are under pressure to relax the protections and controls that existed before, not just in this area, but in other areas of human rights.
From the press?
From the press, amongst others, yeah.
But regardless of the rights and wrongs of it, you can see, I think, in what you're saying, they're under pressure to relax it. In practice, it'd be very hard to relax it because it's all part of the European Convention, as you've been saying. But isn't the technology slightly overtaking the politics here?
Well, it's obviously posed new problems. I don't think it really has. I mean, I think the essential question is not technology. It's whether there is any constraint on what you can say in public. And there is. And should there be? Yes, I think there should be. Plenty of people out there in online land will say, no, there shouldn't be. But I think that's wrong.
Well, plenty of people in the press, alas, too, because yes. The real power behind this is the Murdoch Press, the Daily Mail, the sheer pressure from the tabloids to say we should be able to expose whoever we want. And if it's the Daily Mail, indeed the Murdoch Press too, it's because this upholds morality. If we can expose whatever anybody's doing, it upholds the moral fibre of the nation, which is disgusting stuff, prurient and horrible, and an excuse for poking camera lenses into anybody's bedroom.
And of course, in the present situation, I think one of the examples of that is very worrying is what happens in the current situation if an MP, not necessarily Hemming, but an MP comes to some kind of an arrangement with the press, basically to start saying things which are manifestly untrue, but which will sell a lot of newspapers. How can that be stopped? That's a problem that Parliament really has got to address. And, you know, punishing somebody after the stable door has been shut when the horse has bolted is, you know, part of it. But in the end, you do want to see if there is some way in which the kind of cultural balance that existed for most of the time, it was never perfect, but at least it worked, can be reasserted.
And what about Trafigura? And the right-wing press have all picked up on that. The Guardian story about a company that was up to very bad things, risking lots of lives in Africa, which got super injuncted. Now they've all picked up on it. We didn't report it on the Time, but there's still a point here, isn't there, that we have to worry quite a lot?
Yeah, I mean, the background to that was obviously until Paul Farrey revealed in the Commons that this report existed, we were not allowed to talk about it. Indeed, there was an attempt to stop us even reporting that he had named Trafigura in the Commons. But in fact, that is the really important issue, and it's nothing to do with footballers' private lives. And what's interesting about that is that, in fact, he did pursue the correct form, the correct procedure. He did talk to the Speaker about what he was going to do. What's also interesting is that it revealed that there were no kind of formal routes of communication between courts and Parliament. And there are occasions when there need to be, and Trafigura is obviously one of them. So, plainly, and that was an occasion where the courts now say they were wrong to issue the injunction they issued. And there is no backstop to that, no formal backstop. And that raises all sorts of questions about injunctions, which I'd love to discuss, but it's probably a question for a legal programme. But that's something which the report that came out a week ago from the Master of the Rolls seeks to address. And that's something that probably this joint committee will look at as well.
Well, that report was very interesting because it made the suggestion that the press should be party to super injunctions. So they'd be in the court and they'd be able to say to the bench, don't put an injunction on here for this, this and this reason.
Public interest.
Public interest. Here's the public interest. Here's why. And at least the other side gets put. And the Trafigura case was obviously an appalling bungle and a mistake. It's not that judges will always be right. Nobody will always be right. But that's not an excuse now used by newspapers who weren't at all interested in the Trafigura case at the point at which we were trying to excite their interest in it. Not an excuse for them saying, right, now it's a free-for-all. We can expose anybody who's got any injunction anywhere or on anything, blackmail cases or whatever.
And Polly, just a bit more generally, what do you make... I mean, in America, there's a constitutional right to abortion that I'm pretty sure the Founding Fathers didn't think they were writing into the US Constitution. Do you think now that it's so many decades since these European rights were written, we're just going to see the law kind of evolving in its own way, quite irrespective of what's happening in Parliament? And would that make the politics of the judiciary much sharper business in the future than it's been in the past?
Well, the law has always had to be interpreted by judges either here or else who used to take it to Europe. And then it would be judged there. So it was incorporating it into our own legal system just removed some of the ponderousness of having to go and get other judges elsewhere to decide whether something fell within or not the human rights purview. And I think that the Human Rights Act stands up very well when you read it. And we should be very wary of people saying, oh, this is all out of date. This was all post-war stuff. These are rights to protect people are unpopular and difficult things, and there is always going to be populist ramps of one kind or another trying to press up against it. That's what it's for. It's to protect all sorts of fundamental rights against surges of populism.
Well, the idea that it's possible to write down a law of privacy that will stand the test of time and that can be kind of upheld in the courts is really an absurdity. You are continually balancing rival interests. And what this really shows is the importance of having a diverse judiciary that's capable of understanding and acknowledging, you know, a wide range of points of view.
In other words, it's not all, for example, men, and you know,
and it's not all white, and it's, you know, all of the things that the judiciary still is.
I think that the interesting thing at the moment in Britain today is that there is one large area of British life which regards itself as above the law, and that's the media. And in a sense, the media are in the position that the trade unions were 40 years ago, in which, you know, and we even have press barons, and we used to have trade union barons. And
we had
barons in King John. And basically, they think the law shouldn't apply to them, and they should act the way they want to.
Absolutely. And the Guardian was the only really paper to stand up for the privacy.
This is where we've got to.
We were alone this week, weren't we, pretty much, in supporting the idea that there is value in privacy and that everything shouldn't just hang out there or be tweeted all over the place, that people do have fundamental rights to some privacy if they're not doing anything illegal.
And attacking the judges is the easiest thing for a populist press to do, but I mean the fact is that the judges are as powerful as Parliament makes them. That's our system.
Can I just add one other thing, which is very odd, is that we have become incredibly paranoid these days, the sort of Henry Porter wing, about any CCTV camera watching you walk past in the street. The sort of idea of personal privacy on the one hand, you know, data protection, people are really, have really become really paranoid about the state watching them in any way. Well, actually, Rupert Murdoch's camera lens watching you is a hell of a lot scarier than the state watching you through a CCTV camera.
OK, let's lift our eyes up from the gutter of Fleet Street and try and catch a glimpse of Air Force One over London. President Obama jetted in to lift spirits and meet the Windsors. He also made time for table tennis, Downing Street barbecues, and to talk about another favourite topic on this side of the pond, at least, the special relationship now either up or downgraded to the essential relationship. The main message of his speech was that despite economic woes, it's the West that's still in the driving seat.
The time for our leadership is now. It was the United States and the United Kingdom and our democratic allies that shaped a world in which new nations could emerge and individuals could thrive. And even as more nations take on the responsibilities of global leadership, our alliance will remain indispensable to the goal of a century that is more peaceful, more prosperous, and more just.
Well, Martin, whenever a president's in town, Westminster goes a bit starstruck. But Obama seems to have lost none of his particular appeal on this side of the Atlantic, does he?
Well, I think that's right. This is all to do with the fact that he's not George Bush still, isn't
right.
it? you know, Europeans, British included, in this case we are Europeans, really hated Bush and thought Obama was wonderful, would be wonderful. He's turned out to be less wonderful than many people had hoped, but he's still a lot more wonderful than George W. was. And Michelle isn't too bad either. I mean, she is a very important part of this visit. So, you know, yes, I mean, the political class, and that includes the journalist class, really love America. And so, you know, when he comes and he's given, has these dinners and makes these speeches and, you know, in fact, this morning on my way in, I saw the helicopters flying off to Stansted and I thought, ooh, there's the President of the United States. You know, I mean, it gets us all. You know, he comes in. He didn't really say anything that any other president wouldn't have said. There were a few things on the margins, perhaps. But, you know, basically he gave the standard American presidential speech to a British audience. Not much has changed there. And I don't think there was a great deal of really heavy-duty business done during this time. But, you know, Obama is running for re-election in November 2012. Part of the reason for this European trip is to go to the G8 summit. But another part of it is to shore up some of his electability.
I'm sure that's right.
Why he was in Ireland, and it's partly why he was here too.
And, I mean, it was another of his lofty pieces of poetry there, and as Martin said, it didn't say anything all that new. But isn't there something new we should be saying, which is as power shifts eastward, as he indicates, the special relationships for both Britain and America should increasingly be with Asian countries rather than with each other?
But I think he did hold out that promise. I think the great joyous thing about Obama is that his own personal story is so, you know, plays in so powerfully to the message he was trying to say, which is about the kind of, you know, the triumph of the human spirit and the individual. And, you know, here I am, you know, the grandson of a cook in the British Army, you know, President of the United States. And that is a phenomenal thing to be able to say. And it did move everybody who saw it, even if the rest of the speech was relatively ordinary by Obama's rather high standards. And I think that is really why he can say what, as Martin said, most other presidents would say about the importance of democracy and liberty and so on, and that unique gift that America and supported by other democracies can bring to the world. That's why he can say that with extra power. And I thought that there was beginning to be a really kind of interesting way of talking about the role that the West, the American-led West, can have in its dealings with the new power bases of the world. I thought there was just kind of beginning to be some really interesting ideas there that I can imagine being developed into a kind of doctrine.
Polly, Labour's taking heart, isn't it, from the fact that Obama sounded a bit cold about the coalition's deficit cutting.
Yes, I think that was a bit reassuring, particularly as then straight after that we had the OECD, which is even more remarkable, saying Labour's going that Labour's right and the Tories are going too far too fast. But I think, nevertheless, for the Prime Minister of the day, for David Cameron, you know, it's a great bonus to get some of the stardust rub off on you and to be standing
at a barbecue.
There with your barbecue. Why they were both wearing ties, I don't know. and all of that. It does you no harm, whoever the president is, actually, but particularly this one, who is so well-loved in Europe. And it is partly, as Anne said, the story of upward mobility. But, of course, that story is the great American mirage, which is also a tragedy. Anybody can make it to the White House. We know that America is actually, of all the OECD countries, the least socially mobile. You are least likely, if you're poor in America, to make your way in life.
But he's so cool. That's what it's really about. I mean, don't let's be too kind of statistical about it. He's got a cool.
Oh, he's got everything.
And he can write. The opposite that Bush, or anything that Bush possessed.
Of course, the weird thing about America is, of course, you're right that, you know, that on the whole, the social mobility doesn't really exist in America. But Michelle and Barack both tell that story, and so did Bill Clinton too.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
it's America's tragedy that it believes its own myth, and that's why its politics are so dysfunctional. And you get an overwhelming number of the population voting for vast tax cuts for the very, very rich, all in the belief that somehow, someday, everybody's going to get up there. And it doesn't happen. And it is a tragedy. It's a political disaster.
Well, depending on the outcome of next year's presidential election, this could be Obama's first and last state visit to Britain. But as our colleague Richard Adams in Washington, D.C. says, the Republican Party are struggling to find a candidate to beat him.
Well, as things stand, it's a pretty weak field. It's so weak, in fact, that a lot of Republicans are worried. And there's a desperate hunt on at the moment amongst the Republican commentariat to try and find a sort of saviour and a white horse who can ride into town, because nobody is particularly excited by the three or four major candidates on offer. At the moment, there is the leading candidates, insofar as anybody's a leading candidate, is the former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, and there's the former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, who ran in 2008 to no great success. And outside of them, it starts to look even weaker from a Republican point of view. There's the former Governor of Utah, John Huntsman. And after that, it starts to tail off into just odds and ends and no-hopers and has-beens. And the real search is for candidates who haven't yet entered, the obvious one being Sarah Palin, although a lot of Republicans are less than delighted at the prospect of her being a candidate. Although, I think as things stand, I think she would have a very strong chance of winning the Republican nomination simply because she's far better known than anyone else in the field. Tea Party is part of the problem here. Because of the Tea Party and how it's sort of forced the Republican Party to the right, it's imposed such stringent sort of such a high bar on the potential candidates that it's kept a few relatively strong candidates out of the race. Although the real problem is that just at this point in American politics, there are no obvious Republican contenders who keep all parts of the Republican Party happy and can appeal to, you know, Americans overall. The only obvious one would be the current governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who Republicans adore and has been in the job for long enough that he's got a fair bit of experience, as opposed to some of the other sort of non-candidates who people talk about. But he says repeatedly he's not interested in running, and like a lot of the other stronger candidates, are waiting until 2016 to run because they think they've got a better chance then.
Richard Adams there in Washington. Martin, of course it's early days, as I'm sure you'll rightly want to caution us, but if the right are in the march, if the right is struggling to find a winning march in America, as they seem to be, it's a striking contrast with Europe, isn't it, where we saw bloodletting amongst Spain socialists only this week, and we've seen it in many countries before.
Well, I think it's a specific struggle that the Republicans have got. I mean, Richard Adams was quite right. The Tea Party has pushed the Republican Party to the right, and that has made it very difficult for a traditional, you know, broad church Republican candidate to emerge. That was difficult enough in 2008, and I think it's manifestly going to be much more difficult in 2012. By and large, since the financial system imploded and the recession began, by and large, parties of the right have beaten parties of the left in most industrial countries. There are some exceptions.
Sorry, parties of the right have
beaten parties of the left. In most industrial democracies, you know, there are some exceptions. They hung on in Australia, for example, and they might have hung on in France. They might have won in France had Dominique Strauss-Kahn not been arrested and destroyed that possibility. But I think the thing with the Republicans, is basically they do have the momentum ideologically in America, and that's very, very difficult for Obama. But they are very, very divided, and they are in the end very, very divisive. So reconciling that over the next 18 months to find a candidate is going to be very difficult. And I mean, I suspect it's bound to be one of these. Governors have a bigger opportunity in American politics than senators. And I think, you know, it was quite unusual that McCain emerged out of the Senate to run last time. And I just suspect that one of these governors will end up with it. Romney is the obvious one. He shouldn't be written off just because he's a Mormon, which sounds weird anywhere else in the world. But in America, it's not a huge big problem in the sense that it would be here. So, you know, if the Republican Party is sensible, I think they would put their money on Romney. Whether he gets it or not is another matter.
Polly, do you share that analysis? Do you think that the problems of the right in America are specifically to do with the organisational problems of the Republican Party, and that actually the dark cloud for the left around the world remains?
Yes, it is very riven, the Republican Party, and it's always had this sort of wild streak in it which bursts out from time to time and makes them unelectable, much more than the Democrats have not really had a wild fringe to the same degree. I do think, though, that there's a sort of mood in Europe that's a bit misleading. There was a great big gloom fest a week ago when a whole lot of social democrats social democratic parties from all over Europe met together to sigh together about the loss of social democratic governments around the place. And I think it's quite artificial, because if you look at each country, there are very different reasons why. I mean, Martin mentioned that in France, Strauss-Kahn probably would have won. Sweden, Reinfeldt won for a second time, which is extraordinary because in Sweden usually you get a right-wing government once every so often just as a corrective and then back to the norm. But Sweden hasn't had a great recession. On the whole, people have been thrown out of power because due to the crash and the recession. I mean, there was a moment, for instance, a magic moment, which Blair and Clinton seized when they all met in Florence, where there was a whole lot of Social Democrats. There was Jospin, there was
Schroeder,
there was Cardoso in Brazil, and suddenly they said,
from New Zealand.
And they said, this is the Social Democratic moment. It lasted for just a few months after that.
It was a moment.
Some of them fell out. It was a moment. So you get coincidences, and I think this great social democracy has had it, is another of those coincidences, and each country has very different reasons why.
And the other reason, of course, we shouldn't forget why Obama looks to be coasting towards what could be a victory at the moment is that he recently took out Osama. Do you think, Anne, that progressives in Western Europe need to become killers as well?
I think that's a pretty alarming prospect. I take what Polly and Martin both say, but it does seem to me that there is something lacking in the left's response to, you know, economic crisis, and there is an anxiety there. And the travails of the Labour Party in Britain reflect that slowness to articulate a kind of a way ahead, to find some common ground.
It was the misfortune of being in power when it happened. And wherever that was the case, mostly people got swept out.
I sort of don't really agree with Polly on this. I think, look at what happened in the election in Canada quite recently. You had a right-wing government that was in power. And
came back with more in power.
And it was only in power as a minority. It had two
not much
successive
affected by
minorities.
The recession.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so like Sweden.
Australia,
so,
yeah.
So like Sweden. And therefore, the success of the right there, I think, is very, is quite troubling. I mean, obviously, as you say, there are local factors in everything. I mean, of course, that's true. But it's quite hard to think of a single left of centre party in an industrial country like Britain, where that party is really advancing rather than declining. And, I think there is something historic about this. I don't think it's, I don't think these things are forever. I mean, I don't think, these historic changes are necessarily terminal. It could be, for example, that as Europe and the United States find it more and more difficult to compete internationally against emerging economies, it may well be that we have to begin to get used to a lower standard of living or relatively lower standard of living across the board than we have been used to at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st. And if that happens, well then, a party which says, let's deal with those reduced resources in a more socially just way may have some traction. But I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. I don't see it happening even in 2015 in this country.
But what's interesting,
even though the government's policies are not fantastically popular.
But Martin, you talk as if these were all the similar, either social democratic or right wing. I mean, you look at Angela Merkel's Germany, and this is not at all like Cameron, not at all. For one thing, it's coalition. For another thing, it's that they would be regarded as being to the left.
Yes,
but the Liberal Democrats don't seem to have had much of a look in here. We have a very right wing government here. Germany has a government that would be to the left of Gordon Brown's and Tony Blair's on the whole in terms of its.
I don't agree.
Of its commitment to the welfare state, to not being privatising, to not feeling they need to dig up the welfare state in fundamental ways all the time. I think we would call them fairly social democratic, and that's true. Quite a lot of. I mean, Reinfeldt's Sweden is not at all like Blair or Brown. It's definitely to the left.
I wonder if the right, unlike in say the 30s, is completely committed to low interest rates, exactly like the left is, and that's the thing that's kept the economy from falling completely off the cliff. The interesting question now is what happens on deficits, with the OECD cautioning Britain this morning. If the mood music changes on that, and so that excessive cutting is seen as the problem, then does that present a social democratic opportunity, Polly?
It certainly does. I mean, what it takes for people to trust Labour with the economy in a fundamental way rather than winning a particular argument, we don't yet know. I think it takes people feeling quite a lot of suffering, as they will over the next 18 months, 2 years, and looking around for an alternative. And there's Labour saying, here's an alternative. And you know what? Actually, increasing numbers of economists all over the place are saying, it was George Osborne who crashed the growth that we should have been having.
But the Tories will still be able to say in 2015, you can't risk it with that lot again. And that will be a powerful message, whether it's true or not. And, you know, that's why I'm just cautious about it.
They've got better megaphones because they do have 80% of the press blasting out, you can't trust Labour.
Well, there's something
day
in their
day
argument, too.
Well, as a Guardian leader writer, I'm going to conclude by saying that only time will tell. Thanks to Polly Toynbee, to Martin Kettle and to Anne Perkins. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.